Well, it's almost, how long has it been? 70 years since the Roswell anniversary. The claim, some people claim, and that's, there are many that claim it didn't happen, but there was a crash in Roswell, New Mexico, 1947. One of the most famous people out of that was Jesse Marcel. He was an officer who even took photographs. I remember seeing those photographs of Jesse Marcel Jr. And then, of course, they had to change their story. He did. And, of course, his son afterwards said that they actually did have something and there were beings and there's a lot to it. And you wonder, you know, it's always obviously been downplayed and the crash test dummies and all of that has come forward. And I still never believe what the government said about it. And as you go through life, you meet people and they share things with you. And the person I'm going to bring on today has an amazing story and it's connected to Roswell. So if you'll sit back and listen, and maybe you can offer some help, because it's a really incredible mystery. I think it's one of the most amazing stories I've heard. And his name is Art, and he's from, I think he's down in Florida. Are you with me, Art?
Yes.
Thank you for coming on the show. We've talked about this for quite a while, and you kept telling me, no, TJ, no, TJ, no.
Yeah, it's been a long time, TJ. Yeah, we've been talking about this for quite a while.
Now, I've known you maybe, I've been doing my show for 9 years, and I think shortly after I started doing it, maybe a couple of years after, probably at least 7 years now, we've been contacting back and forth. Does that sound right?
Yeah, most certainly.
Okay. And Art was, he had an interest in UFOs, and we're going to find out why in a little bit. But he's the one who got me interested in looking into the Mackinac Ridge UFO, which, of course, is not far from where I live up here, nor where he used to, not far from where you used to live. And then also what I thought was a truly incredible story was the Kinross incident. I'm so thankful that you had me look into that, because that was something I knew nothing. Nobody up here talks about it. And so, you know, we did some research and we had some people on, and it's pretty interesting. Well, he's got his own interesting story. So first of all, tell me a little bit about yourself, Art. Where did you grow up?
Alpena, Michigan, not too far from the Mackinac Bridge, about 100 miles.
And really, not that far from where I'm at, because I'm another 100 and so miles from there. So really, we were about 200 miles apart growing up, almost.
Well, not only that, I did pass through your neck of the woods now and then. I went to school up at Michigan Tech. So.
Okay, so you're familiar with that. And Tech, of course, known for their wonderful long winters, so you must have loved that.
Yeah, a little longer than Alpena, that's for sure.
Yeah, they got a lot of snow up there. So, and then you moved, you lived in Michigan most of your life, is that correct?
All of my life, actually, and just moved to Florida recently, this okay. past year.
So you like it down there. Isn't it hot, though, in the summer at all, aren't
you? Oh, yeah. It's a change of pace, but it's great.
You don't mind the summers? You stay inside a lot, I'm thinking, in the air conditioning?
Well, just as much as up there in the winter I was okay. hiding, so now okay. down here in the summer I'm hiding.
Okay. To each their own, I guess, right? So when you were in school, you wound up meeting an individual who really changed your life and really kind of changed your purpose. Now, you did a report about UFOs because you believed them. Why did you believe in UFOs at such a young age?
I think it was just a fascinating read for me. A lot of people were into science fiction, and here the UFO topic, the nonfiction books is what I was picking up and reading. And just to say, this is a very long, complicated story with lots of turns to it. So, but yeah, I in sixth grade, we had to give a presentation in class, and it was at near the end of the school year, and a lot of our English grade was based on it, and we got to choose a topic, and I chose UFOs, and I did for one reason, was I already read a lot about UFOs. I already read quite a few books on it. So that part was easy, and it was just, you know, the assignment wasn't really, and in fact, they kind of said it up front, that it, you know, you're not going to be graded on originality or anything. It's just to lay out an outline and to follow it precisely and to make eye contact with the class and talk for 20 minutes on something. So I chose UFOs, and Yeah, and, you know, we had to give an outline like a month ahead of time, and we had to make eye contact with the class. And I don't know if you remember the old index cards, but we had to have the index cards.
And those two, yeah.
Just to look at.
Did you get an A on this, by the way?
I think I got a B plus.
Oh, well, that's not so bad. Now, what happened? There was something that happened at the end of this when you were finishing this up, and you really got upset.
Yeah, and just to tell you, it was very, very conservative what I did. I didn't get into anything really radical, and a lot of the stuff I already read, and I did talk about Project Blue Book, and I got to show some pictures, too, and I know Look Magazine had this big book at the time where they showed pictures, and some of them were identified as, you know, like cloud formations, and others were not.
This is in the early 70s, wasn't it?
This is 1971.
Okay.
Very late in the school year. There was about a month left of the school year.
Okay, so again, UFO, you know, the UFO belief was really big in the 50s. I think it started to disappear, and then we heard a different, you know, people weren't into it as much as they would have been like in the 50s and maybe early 60s. It kind of had faded away a bit. But still, there was, you know, because I know I was into that stuff too back then, and we kind of followed a similar path. But it wasn't as accepted. Like, there was a time, I think, in the 50s when a lot of people believed UFOs. So you're kind of giving a report. Were kids snickering a little bit?
They didn't until near the end. Yeah. But most of the books I was reading was probably from the 60s, because this was 71. And, in fact, there was a book from the 50s I got into also, which I'll talk about. But the whole thing was, though, I think Project Blue Book kind of wrote off the UFO thing in 69, I believe, where they said, hey, everything's hunky-dory, you know, all this stuff is identified, you know, and don't worry about it, you know, there's no problem here. So anyway, I think that's why it calmed down around the 70s. But anyway, yeah, I gave my presentation, and straightforward, and then really, and just before I asked if there was any questions, there was a new kid in our class, which was kind of weird because this was at the end of the school year. And his name was Mike Brown. And he says, the UFOs have crashed. They know they're aliens. It's no big deal. And the whole class started laughing. And I'm sitting there, and it's like, how do I react to that? And then I kind of said something like that. Well, the UFOs, they kind of fly around. They don't really crash. And then I asked, you know, if there was any questions, but everybody was still laughing from his comment. And I thought, you know, it was just to poke fun of it, and I kind of laughed it off too. But yeah, I was a little upset.
Now,
for lack of a better term,
as you're saying this, the UFOs in your mind had never crashed. You hadn't heard of Roswell.
No, not in 71. No, I did not hear that. So what happened there was after there was like a recess, and there was a, you know, a side discussion outside with Mike Brown, and the first thing I said is, why do you say things like that? And I was like, he could tell I was upset. And he says, because it's true. And I said, well, UFOs, they don't crash. There's not one case. I've read books on UFOs. There's not one crash case out there. And he says, well, I want you to talk to my dad. And I said, well, what does your dad have to do with it? Oh, he's a sergeant, and he helped recover some UFOs and some aliens.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, all right, I'll come over sometime and talk to your dad. That sounds good. And the school had no cafeteria, so we all broke for lunch, and we actually went home for lunch. And I actually took a bus home for lunch.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, so I said, well, you know, talk to your dad, and sometime maybe I'll come around. And then in the afternoon, I want you to come talk to my dad tonight. You know, I had to be night.
That same day when he came back from lunch?
Yeah,
he was
exactly.
Saying,
exactly, yeah. Wow. And he made it sound like, oh, he already talked to his dad. Yeah, he's there. He'll talk to me. And he kept pushing, and I really didn't want to. But it's like, oh, you know, as much as he pushed and persisted on it, I said, okay, I won't take the bus, and I'll walk, you know, I'll walk home with you. And when I found out where he's at, it was on my way home anyway, so that was no real issue. So from there, okay, so we're walking, and I, you know, okay, well, tell me something about this. I mean, well, where did this happen? And he didn't want to talk about it. He says, I want you to hear it straight from the horse's mouth. That's what he told me, straight from the horse's mouth. And he was talking about New Mexico already to some extent. And then I asked him, I said, well, where were you born? And he says, Scotland. And I remember that. Scotland was where he was born. So this is interesting. So anyway, he walked me to his house, and we went, you know, he walked like it was his house. We went upstairs, took some steps up to the kitchen, and there was a couple sitting at the table, a kitchen table, and he introduced me, you know, here's Art from my class, and I held up my hand to shake hands with this guy, and he touched my hand for like a minute, and then...
For a minute?
A few seconds, and he pulled it away. He didn't want to shake hands with me. And it was weird because he looks at us for a minute, and then there was a woman at the table too, and she was looking away. And Mike's, we're both standing there and waiting, and Mike, I guess, was expecting him to, you know, say something or, you know, shake hands with me or whatever, but it was just silence.
That had to be awkward.
It was the coldest greeting I ever got from a parent. It was pretty odd. I gotta admit that. So anyway, Mike says, "Well, let's go in the backyard." And as we're walking, you know, down the steps in the backyard, I said, "If we come over at a bad time." He said, "I don't know." You know, he was pretty aggravated. And thinking back on it, I think we walked into some heavy discussion. I really don't think they wanted any kids around. I think they were some heavy talk. That's what I think, but. That's my impressions at the time.
Right.
So he walks me in the backyard, and he says, "Here's my sister, Beverly, and she just turned 13. And she's walking towards us, and I held up my hand, you know, same thing, held up my hand to shake hands. She shook hands with me, very friendly, smiled and everything, but she had a British accent.
She had a British accent.
She had a British accent, and it was so cool because we're talking Northern Michigan. It was the first time I ever talked to anybody with a British accent.
Right.
So I thought it was really neat.
Not exactly the hub of international interaction, Northern Lower Michigan, or maybe nowadays it's more open and has interaction, but, you know, up here where I live, you don't get a lot of that neither. So there are those kind of things that... you know, when you meet somebody like that.
Yeah, and one thing I remember too, he said that she just turned 13, and I don't know if it was 13, you know, if it was her birthday that very same day or roughly that time, but I remember telling Mike, "Well, heck, I turned 13 too in a couple weeks." So from there, the discussions were, you know, what is it like living in town? And I explained it a little bit, and we talked about winters. I know they, you know, asked what the winters were like, and I talked about that a little bit. But as far as living in town, I know the common complaint at that time was finding work. You know, just turning 13 years old, you're a minor, but you know, you're allowed to work minimum wage jobs, but it's very difficult to find work in town. So I know I made a comment, something on the lines of, to find a job at McDonald's, you know, your dad would have to be the mayor or something like that. But I know she started laughing. She thought that was quite funny. So I was just being sarcastic a little bit on it.
So you met the two daughters. They're both British. You met his dad. What was his dad's name?
I don't know.
Mike Bounds?
I never said who.
He didn't tell you?
He never told me who his dad's name was at that time. Oh. And now the other sister was, let me say that, he says, "There's my other sister, Harriet, behind you." And I looked behind us, and she was on the swings with these younger children. And her name was Harriet, and I don't remember much about her. She didn't talk to us. She kind of looked up, maybe, and that was about it. She was real occupied with these children. And then I asked Mike, I said, "Well, who are these children?" "Oh, they're the neighborhood children or something." But I don't remember much about Harriet other than, you know, she was there. So anyway, yeah, and he never said who his dad's name was. Never got into that.
So we really can't connect the dots because he never told you that. But, I mean, later on you're going to, I mean, this is all part of the story. So, Mike, it's just a strange mystery. Now, what else did Mike tell you? He told you some really weird things, didn't he? Like he was stressed out about things?
He was very stressed out about his family situation, which I would find. But anyway, the discussion with Beverly and Mike together was, they're Air Force, you know, they're Air Force kids. You know, they both talk common, like their dad was in the Air Force, and I assume that was his sister, because that's how he introduced me. But they both talking about all these towns they lived at, and they were all over the place. And I was never out of Michigan, so I was kind of like, you know, I never heard of any of these towns. And the only thing I really followed at that time was baseball. You know, I knew baseball teams. Mm-hmm. And I know they mentioned Texas and Florida and New Mexico and England and all these places. But when they mentioned a California town, it kind of rang a bell with me because it reminded me of the San Diego Padres, which was a new baseball team around that time. But it wasn't quite that. It was like San Padre or something like that. It was a San something. And I remember it was like Padre, but not Padre. And this will feed in on something later. But that was the only thing I really remember. With all these other towns they mentioned, I never heard of. And I almost think they were playing with me some because they knew I was never out of Michigan. So they were just kind of naming them all. And so anyway, yeah, I asked him, I said, and when we were done, I asked, why does your sister have a British accent? Because here, she's pale and British, and he's standing right beside her, and he seemed to have, you know, he had a dark complexion. He seemed to talk Southern, at least that was my impression at the time. So I had troubles believing that was really his sister. So when we walked away, I says, why does your sister have a British accent? And he kind of threw his arms up in the air, and real frustrated, like, oh, they're from a different part of the family. And you could tell that really, you know, it bothered him already. He was kind of aggravated about things. But then he started getting real emotional with me. And I said, well, I've got to go. And he wanted to come over that day. He wanted to see my bedroom. I don't know why, but he wanted to see my bedroom. And I wanted to see your bedroom, you know. And I know Beverly was there kind of laughing about it. And I don't know, it was just kind of strange. So I'm walking home, and I'm wondering about all this. It's like, well, this new kid, I mean, is his dad in on this? And what's this alien thing? And I'm comparing it to, you know, well, maybe in their household, you know, how, you know, you got Santa Claus and Easter Bunny. Well, maybe in their household they talk about aliens. I don't know. But it just kind of struck me kind of strange, the whole thing.
So how long did you know this guy? How long did you know Mike?
Just briefly.
In length of time, how many months would you say that is?
I'd say about 2 months. And even then, there was a pause where I really didn't talk to him much. But so anyway, the next day in class, I asked him more questions, and he didn't want to talk about this. He did not want to talk about this UFO thing again. And I asked him, I said, well, what does your dad do? He said he's a cook. And I'm thinking, okay, here's another brush off. His dad was a cook. He had this UFO incident some way, and he just didn't want to talk to it. Well, then he started pushing to see my bedroom again, and I was kind of sarcastic about that. And I said, well, I just have a normal bedroom, you know. Well, I want to see. He says, I want to see what a normal bedroom looks like. So I'm more sarcastic. I said, well, you know, there's a dresser. There's this thing they call a dresser, and it's got drawers and stuff, and anyway, I didn't want to be too rude. I just said, well, you know roughly where I live. You know, if you want to come over sometime, you know, go ahead, you know. So that very same day, you know, there's a knock at my door, and my mom answers, and sure enough, it was Mike Brown. And so I have him come in, and I bring him into my bedroom, and I show him, and I say, well, here's that dresser I was talking about. And he's looking around, and he says, just way over the top, just, oh, my God, is this ever nice? And he's just looking around and everything. And I can't justify how I react to something like that, especially at my age as a kid. But I just said, it's just a damn bedroom. Anyway, he says, I want you to sit down here. And I had a coffee table chair thing. That's where I did my homework and my artwork and stuff. And he wanted me to sit down right there, so I sat down, and I don't know what I'm in store for here. And he stood behind me, and he says, listen to me. He says, appreciate the family you have, the house you live in. And I was kind of uncomfortable, so I started to stand up, and he was kind of pushing down on my shoulders for me to stay seated. And I got up, and I looked around, and he was in tears. He was crying.
That's all stuff at the time you didn't understand, but over time it would become pretty clear as to perhaps what he was talking about. Because, you know, these interactions that you talk about with Mike, they played a part in how you started to formulate. But this didn't, it took you quite a while to start to realize. I mean, you kind of let that go, didn't you? After he left and he moved away from your life, you didn't think twice about it, did you?
No, I didn't. But something was tearing this kid apart. And it had something to do with the British sisters, and I'll get more into that, but it had something to do with them, most obviously. And
right. So how long was it, I mean, you forgot about it. When was the next time that you even thought about Mike Brown?
It was much, much later. But anyway, he started to go through my stuff, and I sat there, and I'm thinking, how in the hell did my UFO presentation lead to this? It's like, this is all strange to me. It's like, and again, my UFO thing was so conservative. It wasn't really, you know, UFOs are explained, here's some pictures. It wasn't anything really wild, and I was actually reading a lot more deeper stuff than when I presented. And so anyway, he started to go through my stuff, and he thumbed through my books, and I was surprised he wasn't really interested in the UFO books. And he went through my albums, and he wanted to hear, I had my sister's Woodstock album. He wanted to hear that, so I put that on for a bit. And but what interests him the most was I had this box of Mellow Cup cards. Does that ring a bell with you, TJ? Do you remember Mellow Cup cards?
Yes, I do. Yep.
They're the coin things where you tape $5 worth and you send them in and you get the free candy bars. And, that, and my sister got me into that, but he wanted me to take those out, and he looked at me, and he was so amused by them for some reason. I said, all the kids do that here, you know. But anyway, I started to have a real guilt feeling. It's like, I don't know if this kid has a bedroom or anything. And I asked some questions, and he really did not want to talk about his family situation at all. It's something he just didn't want to talk about. So anyway, I got an excuse to get him out of the house. I got to feed my dogs. So I went outside, and I further talked. And I told him, I said, you know, when it comes to the UFO stuff, I want to poke a stick at that topic again, bring the topic back to UFOs. And I did. I says, you know, I really think there's a cover-up. I'm reading more stuff right now, and I really think there's a cover-up. And he says, oh, yeah, there's definitely a cover-up. So right away, I'm asking, well, name me a case. Name me one case that you think's a cover-up. And he wouldn't say anything. And I said, well, do you read any books on it? And he says, well, me and my dad, we talk about UFOs all the time. And I'm thinking, oh, boy, now we're going to go back to the crazy UFO crash story, which at that time I didn't believe any of that because I didn't know any of that stuff happened. So anyway, I started talking about the Kinross incident. And he was he didn't seem to know anything about it, and he seemed surprised. And I was at that time reading the Donald Kehoe book, and I was just, that really, I think, soaked me into the UFO topic even more, because that should have got more attention than Roswell, actually, the Kinross incident. So anyway, a couple other times, he wanted me to go to his 12th birthday party, and it was at a friend that we both knew. It was in his basement, and I know his mom arranged it real quick. I think it was just a 2-liter pop with cups on a coffee table with some party cloth thing over it. And but yeah, I know we talked about New Mexico some, and he did talk about White Sands. I remember him definitely mentioning White Sands. Now, here's the thing. He might have mentioned Roswell back then, but it would have not meant anything to me. I didn't know anything about Roswell, and it certainly didn't ring a bell with me. So if he mentioned Roswell back then, I would not recognize or remember that. But I do remember the White Sands.
Okay, so Mike, I mean, this is obviously a strange dude. He just seems like he's got a lot of issues, and yet he seems to know a lot about UFOs. And at the time, you didn't know anything about the Roswell. So he moves away, and years later,
he came to my house to say goodbye. And this was shortly after his birthday, and he was very teary eyed. He was shaking, and he said he was moving to England, and I said, that is so cool. And, you know,
he said he was moving to England.
He said he was moving to England. And okay. He said, unless they bury me along the way.
He said that too? You're sure?
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
Okay.
And And I didn't know how to react to that. And so anyway, he looked around my bedroom again on things, and then I did poke a stick one last time at the UFO topic, and I told him, I says, you know, it was a little aggravating in class. And then he says, did you know what happened? And I says, well, what do you mean what happened? And he says, well, cops were chasing UFOs along the Mackinac Bridge. So anyway, I'm thinking, why is he coming up with another ridiculous story? He just told me one already, and then he's got these family issues. Now he's bringing up another ridiculous story about UFOs along the Mackinac Bridge that the cops were chasing. And okay, so I asked him, I said, well, where'd you hear about this? And he said, it was in the newspaper. Well, there was nothing. There was nothing in the newspaper on that.
Funny how you knew about that. So
I don't know. I thought it was made up. You know, the one thing about it, everything he said, I thought he was just trying to get attention.
Mm-hmm.
I thought all it was. But the British sisters, that one, you know, I talked to Beverly for about 10 minutes. I mean, she was very real. She had a British accent, and she was there. That part is hard.
Let me ask you this, Art. Did you have a crush on her?
No.
Okay. You didn't want to date her at that point?
I thought the British accent was really cool.
You thought it was pretty hot? You didn't think it was? Okay. So what happens next? You don't come across anything until what? You started to research like Roswell when, in the 80s?
Well, I went on to, a junior high at that point, and high school and college, and I had a family, I had a career, and I really, you know, a little bit of talk here and there on UFOs. And I would talk about Mike Brown a little bit. Classmates, hey, do you remember him? Because I was still puzzled by that whole thing, and I was wondering how he was doing in England. Well, yeah, the first I heard of Roswell was in the late 80s. And even then, that was probably already about 10 years late. I think Stan Friedman talked to Jesse Marcel in the late 70s, but I did not know anything about Roswell until like 88, 89, and it was a TV show, UFO Cover-Up Live. It was from Washington, D.C.
I remember that. I remember that show.
There was a William Moore that was on there, first talking about Roswell, and I heard about that, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, this is first I heard about a crash saucer. And I'm thinking, right when I'm thinking about Mike Brown, it's like, I wonder if Mike Brown, what he was hinting at, has something to do with this. Well, I went and got the booklet the next day. You know, they had the TV special, and I went and got the book that William Moore wrote, and I went through that, and it's like, yeah, New Mexico, crash UFO. It's like, it already started me thinking about Mike Brown, and then it really gained momentum because, like the mid-90s, and all the more witnesses came out, and I was looking, I was kept waiting for the name Brown to come up, because I was thinking, okay, Mike's going to eventually show up and talk about his dad or something, you know. Well, then eventually, in the documentaries, there was this Beverly and Harriet and Ada Brown that start talking about Sergeant Melvin Brown. And then when they said he was a cook, then I'm thinking, oh, my God. I remember Mike, you know, brushing me off saying his dad was a cook. So anyway, it's like, this has got to be a connection here. There's really got to be a connection here. And I started to, it was later when I started to contact the researchers, but the thing about Melvin Brown, though, is there's very little about him on the Internet to start with. It's Melvin E. Brown. What does the E stand for? And you can't, at least back then, you couldn't find one researcher could even tell me what his middle name was. But he was the one that supposedly saw the aliens. He was the one that they told him never to look under the tarp. And guess what? He looked under the tarp.
Right. So Melvin Brown, at this point, you're starting to think is Mike Brown's father. And also those two gals, which they went on. And you can check it right now if people listening. You can go and Google that and see them being interviewed and talking about their father and that he was at Roswell and he saw things. So you got to kind of connect with all that. And the gals looked like the people you knew, right? I mean, this was several years later, but they looked like the ones that you knew back from when you were in grade school.
Well, I can say Beverly definitely looks like the one I talked to, but I don't remember the guy that wouldn't shake my hand, I really don't remember much about what he looked like. He only stood there for a few seconds.
Well, if that was Melvin Brown in 1971, and he was in Roswell in 47, I mean, that still was another 24 years later. And if he's a young man, let's say he's a young man, he's got to be probably in his 40s, I would guess, by then, right?
In fact, I made a comment to Mike because somewhere along the way, my parents were quite old. I was the youngest kid in the family, and my parents were quite old when I got my teens. And the only thing I could say was he seemed to be roughly my dad's age. That's the only thing I remember about
him. How old was your dad?
I think my dad was in his 50s at that point. Early 50s.
Well, that could be possible then, Mike Melvin Brown. The thing is, in all of this, Art goes to school with a kid who claims his father is a cook and was at Roswell and witnessed things. And there's not many people that can go around saying that to begin with. And then the strange part about all this is that it's almost like Mike, it doesn't add up. I don't want to give it all away, but I mean,
I know, and I can't prove anything, but here's the real icing on the cake. You know, around the Roswell time, all of a sudden, I'm following Roswell pretty closely. And I got to admit, it was quite a few years later before I ever told a soul about this whole Mike Brown thing, which today I think I regret that I didn't keep it to myself. But I finally told my family, and it's kind of folklore around here. But anyway, in 2001, there was a disclosure project where some witnesses came out in Washington, D.C. and presented what they witnessed, and there was a guy on there that talked about the Mackinac Bridge and police chasing UFOs. So then again, it's like, now this, you know, 20 years later, now it's 30 years later, it's like, this whole thing, to me, it's like a practical joke played on me where I don't discover the punchline until 20 or 30 years later, because all of a sudden, there's this police chasing UFOs along the bridge, and this happened. I got to believe this happened in Kinslow, even though he didn't really say that. But here's the thing. Mike told me this story in July of 1971. However, this witness talked about this happening in the fall of 1972, and I did try to contact this witness through the Disclosure Project. I never could get anywhere with that, but I just wanted to ask if he could have been off a little bit on his timing. I did find out, though, he was at that Kinslow Air Force Base also in July of 71. So maybe, you know, maybe there's a tie-in to this. I don't know. But then I'm thinking more like, how did Mike Brown get all the scoop on all this stuff? It's like, what the heck, you know?
Well, that's interesting, that part of it. But his dad, well, his supposed dad, Melvin Brown, was at... You were able to track down a lot of different things, and there was a connection. And even though it was several years later, you were able to piece together some interesting things about... The biggest thing that led to this was that the daughters came out after Melvin died and did videos, right? That's what really got you to know, okay, they're over there in England. Where's Mike? How come Mike's not a part of that family? What happened to him? I know you talked with me about that, and you thought, well, maybe they buried him somewhere. Remember you said maybe it was in the backyard behind the house where he supposedly lived?
I had all kinds of theories there for a while.
This was driving you nuts. You know, Art's a pretty nice guy. He's just a regular guy, but now he's become obsessed with this because he's been told by the sisters and the family that there never was a Mike Brown, and this is the big mystery. You've been able to piece all this other stuff together, and they told you point blank, basically, didn't they, that he never existed, and they never were over here in this country.
Exactly, they claimed they'd never been to the United States. Well, I'll take that back. Harriet, I think, was in the United States later years, in with her husband. I think maybe in she was in her 30s or something. They're both claiming they weren't here at that time frame. And that bugs me because I still think there's some record trace. You know, you don't do international travel and there's no documentation on it. And I do know that Obama's mom, they traced her some of her flights and stuff. So some of the information becomes public information eventually.
Right. So you were not able to prove, but you believe that this woman who went on, basically was interviewed over in England about her father, and you... And her father is Melvin Brown. Her name is Harriet, and her father was at Roswell, even though some of the things add up, but some of the other ones don't. But how could it possibly be someone else? How could it possibly be another family? When you look at, it's very obvious that this is the same group of people, the same, what happened to Mike Brown?
Well, yeah, and the thing is, okay, we've got the, I label them the Roswell Browns and the Michigan Browns that I met, and I think there's a connection. I think it's the same family, but I treat them as separate entities, though, and I've went and researched this, and I have found out a lot about Melvin E. Brown through the years, a lot more than what the researchers have, and I did get his military assignments, Air Force military assignments, which I was going to provide to you. But so there's a parallel effort here. One is trying to find out what I can about the Roswell Browns, and the other is to try to find out what I can about the Michigan Browns and see if there's any connection between them.
Melvin was married in 47 when he was in Roswell? Do you know if he was married?
No, he was not. He did not get married until 52.
Okay.
1952.
And what is his wife's name?
His wife's name is Ada, and they did, they talk about this during the interviews, they did come to the United States in the 50-51 time range. It was a short time they were here. And the oldest daughter was born at that time. And the oldest daughter, which is I call the third daughter, no one's ever talked to her. She's never been interviewed. But anyway, she was born around that time. And things didn't work out. And if I understand it right, Ada did not like the United States. She really wanted to live back home in her hometown of Hemel Hempstead. So they eventually moved back there. But Melvin was never stationed in Hemel Hempstead at that point. He was stationed at Chicksands. He was stationed at Scotland. And that was just it. When I ran across Scotland and his records, I'm going, oh, my God, that Mike mentioned something about Scotland.
See, there's another thing that ties in. If Mike is not the son, why is he talking about living or being born in Scotland? And also, you mentioned earlier, he's mentioning going back to England with his family. Now, what's crazy about all this, and I don't want to get the cart ahead of the horse, because I just want people to understand this, Art. We've gone down, quite a bit of detail, but people need to know, and we're going to get to this, that you met Mike several years later, and he pretty much denied all of that, didn't he?
Yes, he denied the British sisters. Now, on record, it says he was born in Alabama. Yeah. He never told me he was born in Alabama. And he had no sisters. He had brothers. I never met the brothers.
You only met the two gals.
I met the two gals. And the house that he walked me to, he never lived there.
He didn't live there.
He never lived there. So I'm trying to figure out who lived at that house. Now, here's it. I shared this story with Stanton Friedman quite a few years back, and he helped me. He actually called the Alpena Library, and they looked up on the city directories, and they looked up 71, and they looked up currently at that time, and found out which neighbors are still there that lived there in 71. And he gave me the list, and I was already talking to one or two of them. And there was one in particular I finally made contact with, and the only thing they remember was somebody in that house. And by the way, that house was rented out to Air Force people.
Mm-hmm.
And whoever was in that house had to return to England due to their family. Somebody told me that, but they couldn't give me a name, and whoever it was, they were there for a short time. Such a short time that the phone book nor the city directory would pick up on the name. So I could never tie in a name to that address.
It kind of adds up to what you were speculating all along, that that could have been Melvin. Certainly seemed like Melvin, and had his British daughters with him. And then another thing is, because we've gone round and round about this too, wondering and speculating, what was going on? Why were they denying that Mike was the brother, was their brother? And, I mean, we'll never understand Mike's story as to why he changed it. But why was all this kind of being covered up? I mean, I understand they're covering up Roswell, but covering up something within the family, too.
Well, I can speculate things, and I try to stick with facts, and I don't really want to spell it out, but I will say one thing, though. And during their interviews in the early 90s, and this is based on something Donald Schmidt said on one of the shows, and their first interview, their very first interview in the early 90s, Ada's crying, and she's talking about Melvin, and he's on his deathbed, and she says, that Melvin says, "You know, I've always been faithful to you." And then he starts talking about the Roswell. Yeah. And some people found that so odd because it's, what does Melvin's faithful have to do with Roswell?
Right, right.
And then I know Donald Schmidt made a comment on the show like, well, see, that's, you know, he takes it a different way. He's saying something like, well, that shows that their marriage is just as important as Roswell to them. And but I look at that different.
You're kind of speculating that maybe Melvin had some kind of relationship and that Mike was not Ada's true son, is basically what you're saying. What you're thinking could have happened.
It's one of those speculation paths you can go down.
Well,
but
it seems
certainly nothing confirms it. Nothing.
Right. Absolutely. Nothing, and we're not trying to bring a bad name to the family, especially since Melvin's passed on. But it's just a weird thing, and why Mike was acting so weird at the time when you were 11 or 12 years old and all the things he's saying. And then you met him. When did you meet him again? How many years later was it after 71?
2015 was, I believe, the year. It was just a couple of years ago, and he already had health issues. And we first corresponded by mail. I sent him a class picture of our class, and just to, you know, hey, you recognize anyone here? And then he wrote back, and eventually we got together. We had dinner together, he was already really struggling with his health, and he was already in pain. But I asked a few questions. How about these British sisters? He denied that completely, and he denied walking me to the house and everything else. And I walk away from that thinking, well, did I really dream this up? It's like, I don't think I dreamed any of this up.
Yeah, that's weird. That's the weird part. You think if you finally met the guy after that many years, you could maybe sit down with him and get some answers, and it's just like, he acted like it never happened, but yet he remembered you from school, right?
Well, here's the thing. Okay, after he passed away after that, we've talked about getting together again, and it never happened. He passed away. So I had a little correspondence with his wife, and she basically told me that the only thing he remembers about me was the Mellicott cards, and he brought that up quite a few times in the past. That, oh, there was this kid that saved Mellicott cards, I remember, from town. That's the only thing he remembers from me. So it's like, okay, so I think he's avoiding things is what I think. And the wife says he was never into UFOs, never was into the topic. Then I had a short discussion with one of his daughters, and she also said that he would never mention Scotland, never mention New Mexico, never mention any of that. He was, if anything, he avoided UFOs. He never talked about it. So that all strikes me out, too. Then another thing, though, when I first started looking up Melvin Brown, the first thing I found was one of his records was Ancestry.com, and there was a whole bunch of Melvin E. Browns that are cooks. There was a bunch of them. And this was a World War II vet, so they had a weekend where you could free access some of their military files. So I had all these Melvin E. Browns, and I couldn't pick one from another because it's a common name, and there was a whole bunch of them that were cooks during World War II. But there was one in particular I looked at. The only reason why I did is I had this San Pedro staring at me. San Pedro, San Padre. That's that one town that both Beverly and Melvin talked about. San Pedro, California. There it is, staring me in the face. Well, so I that particular one, I copied the text from it, and I actually contacted Kevin Randall, and I said, could this be the Melvin Brown from Roswell? And he wrote back, and he says, the age is about right. It could be. I would find out later that was indeed the first thing I collected that was definitely the real Melvin E. Brown. So there's something from Beverly and Mike Brown's discussion to help me pick out the right Melvin E. Brown on all these military records I was looking at. Hmm. Yeah, so it's like...
Can I ask you a question, Art? Can I ask you a question, Art? Because people might be listening and they're going, wow, this guy is really obsessed over this. Why did you become so obsessed over this?
Well, you know, I'm kind of putting it down now after all these years. It's like, all right, I'm going to talk to you about this and hopefully just put it down because nobody, you know, there's no confirmation. They're denying that they
but
were
what
in
drove
the United
you
States.
To what drove you to find these answers? Your interaction for Mike, was it Mike? Was it Melvin? What was it, the whole story?
I think the whole story, but what leads to so much more is, let's say somehow I find proof that was indeed Melvin Brown that I almost shook hands with and almost, you know, he almost told me some things. And it leads to more questions. What the heck is a Roswell witness doing in Alpena, Michigan in 71? It's like, it's a bigger mystery yet. It's just, it's just fun to think about and try to uncover something.
You know, that is a good question, too, because he wasn't stationed there, right? There's nothing that proves that Melvin was stationed there in Alpena, right?
Right, and there's an Air National Guard base, which is mostly a training place. So it's like, what would someone like that be doing in Alpena? It doesn't make any sense.
Unless he was up there. Now, we've speculated on this, and again, to anybody that might be a family of Mike or Melvin Brown or the Browns in general, this is not meant to hurt anybody. I would never do a show like that, but you're curious, and I think you have every right to ask questions. Mike.
Well, I think Melvin Brown is an honorable man. I think he's an honorable man.
Absolutely.
And all these witnesses that came out, I there really is something, I believe, to the Roswell incident, and for them just to blow it off that, you know, it's a balloon or it's a crash dummy or something. It'd be nice to get
it's kind of cool to think that you sat in the same class with a kid whose father was at Roswell. And now, at the time, I would have not even heard of Roswell like you. But years later, you go, wow, I wish I could have had an opportunity to question this individual, but I'm sure he was told to keep his mouth quiet on many things. So what happens is that the family is over there in England. Mike stays here, and he's got a completely different story when you meet him again, claiming he was born in what state was it he said now?
Alabama.
Alabama. And now when you meet him in 2015, he's married. Does he have any kids or anything like that? Oh, he had a daughter, you said, at least, right?
Yeah, he had two daughters, I believe.
Okay. And then
the one I did correspond.
And then he passed away about a year ago. Is that what it was?
Yeah.
And Melvin's been gone for quite a while, I'm guessing, too.
Melvin died in 86.
Okay.
February of 86.
Well, you really know all of this. This is amazing. It's a story within itself. I find it fascinating how you have all these facts. So you went, turned, unturned every stone you could to try to find out about Melvin Brown, find out if there was a connection with Mike Brown and the family and the people that you thought. And in the end, what do you come away with from all of this? Do you believe it was the same person that you met?
I seem to think so. But what's added to this, though, is I do have Melvin's military assignments, and there's a lot of mystery just to that. Putting this Mike Brown story aside for 1 minute, there's a lot of fascination and mystery to Melvin's military assignments, and I'd like to further talk with you about that sometime.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, he seemed like an individual that he was just a cook, but boy, he sure was in a lot of places. And that
you're not kidding. It's unbelievable.
Maybe he wasn't just a cook. Maybe he was more than just a cook. You know, this is done out of the greatest respect for Melvin and Mike and their family. I just found this to be such a fascinating mystery because you tell me this story about knowing this kid when you were in sixth grade, and he kind of interrupts you when you're giving a speech, and then you're kind of ticked at him, and you become friends with him somewhat, although he seems really odd, and he's talking really weird as far as, like, his family's going to leave him behind or something could happen to him, and he's got to go to England, and he's upset about that. And what it really appeared to happen is that maybe they gave him up for adoption or a foster home, and they kind of left without them. That's what's, you know, if you piece it together with what you've done, it appears that they could have somehow parted ways. Or maybe he went to stay with his real mother. Or, I don't know, they were moved off. Now, the family he went to stay with was named Brown as well, wasn't it?
Yes, that's what's also a mystery on this, is that it's like a Brown passed onto a Brown, if you go down that path that you're talking about.
And is that related? We don't know if it's related to Melvin Brown.
Yeah, Melvin had a twin brother, Marvin.
I mean, could have been cousins, could have been anybody.
Right, and I've tried to go down that tree, and I have investigated that, too. I went back and looked at census, and Melvin was from a pretty large family.
Yeah, well, here's what are the odds that, okay, Mike Brown, when you meet him in 2015, he claims his real parents live in northern or live in upper Michigan, not that far from me, towards the Sioux, and they have, is it John Brown? Was that what his father's name was?
On record, yes.
So he's living with, his parents were John Brown, and what was the mother's name? Do you know?
Ann, I think.
John and Ann. So what a coincidence. The people, the Mike Brown that you knew and the Harriet were the, you know, their father was Melvin. And they now, he's also with other Brown family. Do you think there's any way possible that maybe you just mixed it all up, that it really was John Brown, Mike's parents? I mean, he told you he was from Scotland, right?
He said he was born in Scotland. That was what he
said.
Told
he was going to England. Do you know if John Brown, because you looked up John Brown, did he ever go to England? Was he ever stationed in those places?
No idea.
Okay. So we're trying to make it clear as to whether or not Mike Brown was the son of John Brown, who, by the way, was never at Roswell. Do you know that about John, if he served in Roswell?
I think he's too young to be, I can't remember the age off the top of my head, but I think he was too young to be at Roswell. I wondered about that, too.
Okay. So what we're thinking, this is me thinking out loud. Art may not even think it either. Melvin Brown and his wife, and Melvin maybe has a son out of wedlock, and he either leaves Mike with, this is why Mike is so distraught, back in sixth grade, he leaves it with the family, with another family, maybe a relative of some sort, because they're named Brown as well, and they go on and live their life. Something they obviously don't want to admit to, Harriet, you know, when you contact them later in the 90s, was it the 90s when you contacted them?
No, it was 2006,
okay.
I think.
2006, you contact them, and they totally deny it, and they're upset about it, and they're angry about it. And then when you see Mike in 2015, of course, he totally denies all of that. But the puzzle, you know, the pieces to the puzzle point that that's his sister's, and Melvin was his dad. And you've been on this journey now for how many years? You said 2000. When did you first start really getting into this?
2006 was when I really started getting into investigating Melvin Brown and trying to find Mike Brown. And and I think partly because it was a time where my, you know, career and family was kind of settled, and I had more time to think about this stuff, too. But, yeah, 2006.
So if anybody wants to let us know, if you know anything, feel free to contact me. You can always send me an email. You can always find a way to contact me through my website. We're going to always do this with the greatest respect. We're not going to step on anybody's feet. That's not the intention here. But to me, it's just a really cool mystery. And not only that, it's a connection to our past about Roswell, which this summer, didn't you say this summer is going to be the 70th anniversary of Roswell?
Yes. July will be the 70th anniversary of Roswell. And we'll probably never know the real truth behind it.
No, but there were, you know, and the people are dying off that were, you know, and then maybe the next generation, those people are dying off as well. So things like this, in a way, are kind of important because we need to remember some of those things. Of course, the daughters, they had that interview. Harriet was in it. And who's the other gal?
Beverly and Harriet are the known Brown sisters.
that are in this interview, and they are talking about their father and his experiences. Anybody can Google that and find it on YouTube, the interviews that they did. They did a few interviews over when they were over, and well, they're still over in Britain, but I mean, they probably did two or three interviews, I think.
Yeah, there's actually a very, very detailed interview on YouTube, and it was on British TV in the 90s, Dr. Knapp's Talk Psychic Show. Nabo Shaban is his name, and some of us call him the Leprechaun. He looks like a leprechaun, but he's the one that interviewed them, and they go in a lot of detail on there, and I'd say it's probably an hour, hour and a half of interviews of Beverly, Harriet, and Ada. But one thing that's kind of odd, again, is they never mentioned any of the places where Melvin was stationed in England. They seem to avoid that. They never mentioned anything about Scotland. And by the way, Harriet was born in Scotland. That I did find out. So there's still something weird about, but yeah, their interviews are quite interesting.
Yeah, it ties in closely in a way to what you came to know and the things you experienced. And what do you hope to accomplish out of all of this? You've put a lot of your life into this, a lot of hours. What are you hoping to gain out of this, Art?
Nothing really. I mean, it's just, it's interesting. It's kind of like, you know, some people read novels, and I'm kind of living one, I guess you could say. And, you know, hobbies, it's more interesting than collecting stamps, put it that way.
I mean, it's a fascinating story. Maybe you knew the son of Melvin Brown, and Melvin Brown being the man that was a witness at Roswell. It certainly appears that way. Unless maybe they abducted the real Mike Brown and they replaced him with a different one. I mean, it's weird how he totally changed his tune. But then again, I suppose maybe some people said, okay, you need to be quiet about this. You know, we know that if you witness things, they may show up at your door, and they may tell you, that's enough of that. Keep quiet about it. I know people that have had encounters with officials. Once they witness stuff, they start showing up and telling them, mm-mm, you didn't see anything. So maybe something like that happened. It's really an incredible mystery. I love the story, and I love the fact that you've taken this much time to do research on it. It's fascinating.
It's just a hobby on the side, but it's a lot of years. But really, I mean, there's not a whole lot of time put on it at any one time. But through the years, it kind of adds up. You know? But it's just a hobby. It's just an interesting hobby, and that's how I've looked at it.
Yeah, but I know you've been frustrated with it, right? You've been frustrated, too, with it, right, Art?
Well, a lot of dead ends. I mean, they just surprise when someone tells me something that's totally different later, and people that I believe are in the United States are claiming they were not, And again, records will confirm that. If records ever surface that they were in the United States as children, they've got a lot of explaining to do.
Right.
And as far as I think if they flew here from England, I believe it was the weekend of May 1st, 1971. They might have taken a day off or two of school and wrapped around that. And I believe Monday, May 3rd, was the day that I met Beverly and Harriet.
Now, let me ask you this, because this just hit me. If Mike was going to school here and had been enrolled for only a couple of days, he was a new kid, right?
Well, that was my understanding. They just moved into town, and that's what I interpreted everything to be. But come to find out, Mike was at different schools in Alpena. He was at four different schools, and he lived four different places within a year and a half range. So he was jumping around schools. And I think when he joined my class, he might have already passed his previous, wherever he was at, and it was just to finish the school year there. That's what I suspect now.
Now, you know, and the thing is, did you ever try to find out if he was going to school, weren't his sisters, or were they just flown over just for a little bit? Were his sisters...
I think they were flown over to visit, because I immediately, when I started asking questions with the school records and stuff, there was no confirmation of those sisters, that Mike Brown had any sisters. I don't think they were enrolled in school here, even though they kind of led me on like they were, but I don't think they were. I think they were visiting around that weekend.
And then they shortly, the whole family took off with the exception of Mike and went back to England.
I believe so, yes.
And what about Melvin's wife? Was it Ada? Is that her name?
Yes.
Did she come over with the daughters, do you think?
I don't know. I suspect she might have been the one sitting at the table. And I didn't really look at her. I just know she sat at the table and she looked at the wall when we were standing there. And then even Melvin, after he touched my hand, and he kind of just looked at the wall like, you know, we came in at a bad time. That may be Ada, it may not. I don't know. But I seem to think that she probably flew the... Because they were minors.
Right.
Beverly was 13
right.
at the time. Harry was, I think, 10. And I saw... Yeah, I think Ada probably flew them over. Who knows? Maybe it'll talk Melvin into coming back. But during their interviews, they're going to say Melvin never returned to the United States after the early...
Well, that's a good point. And I mean, this is all speculation. Because what would Melvin be doing here with his son... And maybe he was going to stay here, and they all came back to smooth things over and leave as a family, but they also couldn't take Mike with them. And I know a lot of times, you know, my parents were both divorced when I was, you know, when I was born, they had been both divorced once. And I had two half-brothers that I never met. Well, I met them once at my dad when my dad was really sick, in the 80s. But the common thing for parents to do back in the 60s and even early 70s is that one parent would keep one set of the kids, maybe the boys, another parent would get the girls, and a lot of times after that, you never had contact with them again. And I know that because of what I witnessed with mine. And people say, well, how could you live like that? How can people do that? Because people got on with their lives. I think that comes to being maybe the depression and difficult times. People made the best of things and they moved on. It's, you know, my mother, her son stayed with his father and her daughter stayed with us. She would have contact with her son years afterwards and he'd come and visit and stuff like that. And he was welcome. But it's still, I'm sure he felt like an outsider because we didn't go to visit him very much. It's just that he kind of moved on with his life and we moved on with ours. I don't know if you ever experienced anything like that, Art, but that's stuff that I saw firsthand, that parents, there was a time when if they split up the kids, people just kind of went their way. Now, you know, people have a lot of contact with their children. So who knows? The truth behind all of that. It is a really interesting story. Fascinating, Art. Fascinating. Anything else you want to tell us? Because we're just about out of time. And I mean, we can do this again, but anything else you want to say?
I think I'm all set, TJ. As always, it's a pleasure talking to you. And thank you.
Thank you very much for sharing that story. The story of Mike Brown and Melvin Brown and the Browns and the family. And if anybody has information, if you went to school in Alpena, Michigan, or you know somebody in 1971 and you want to contact us, that would be great. We're not trying to, again, Art is not trying to hurt anybody's feelings. He's just curious and wants to see if we can find some answers. And I think that would be, maybe it benefits everybody. So thank you for listening. Thanks a lot, Art.
Bye.